The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
But I began to take a particular interest in a range of reforms that took place in Russia before the Bolshevik Revolution. They're called the Stolypin Reforms. And I'm going to ask my guest to speak a little bit about them and then to entertain a theory that I have. So, Matthew, what were the Stolypin reforms and what was the condition in Russia at the time that led to them?
That's a very complicated question. This isn't a subject of history that can be summarized in a slogan or two. The reforms of Peter Stolypin, who was prime minister under Tsar Nicholas II, really concerned the idea of creating a yeoman class of farmers to permit at least the legal option of leaving the commune and being allotted a certain relatively small portion of land that then could be owned outright and even possibly alienated. Now, along with that came the existence of something that had been around in Russia for a while but had fallen out of existence, and that is the peasant land bank, and the idea of being able to forward low-interest loans guaranteed by the state to these peasants who wanted to do that. Now, I know the literature, the academic literature on this subject extremely well. These reforms were occasioned by the revolution of 1905-1906, Stolypin was attempting to, number one, stem the tide of any further revolutionary movements, and of course he demanded that enforcement against revolutionaries proceed apace, and number two, to try to undercut the real reason, or what at least in his mind, for the revolutionary movement of 1905, which was the land hunger that had come into existence, especially in the central provinces of Russia, from the liberation of the serfs in 1861. Now, the problem with the Stolypin reforms is that only a relatively small percentage of the commune members actually left the commune. Depending on who you read, it's anywhere from 1% to 10%. Normally, they were, I think 10% is a little high, but normally these were the upper level of the peasantry who already was quite successful within the commune and had collected a little bit of capital and wanted to branch out on their own. For the most part, though, the overwhelming majority of the commune members stayed together. The commune, I have a tendency to be partial to the commune because it was responsible for a tremendous amount of agricultural growth from 1861 to 1900. And at the very least, it maintained a certain fair distribution of land, not just the amount of land, but also the quality of land. So for the most part, you had the habit of the communal life, and most peasants stayed there. But that doesn't mean that a portion of your most successful peasants did take advantage of this legal right that they were now given to get land on their own. You did have a small sort of middle-class property-owning movement develop between 1906, 1907, and World War One. Unfortunately, World War One and then the subsequent Civil War largely destroyed that class.
Okay, so I've pronounced Stolypin very much phonetically as a dumb Westerner would, so you do a much better job of that. Now, the reforms then, people who went out into these areas, Were they given really barren land to build on, or was the land, had it been cultivated at all, or what was the condition?
That's often hard to figure. Places like Ukraine, you know, you didn't really have the tradition of the commune. In Ukraine, you really already had a yeoman farmer, or at least the farmstead of the extended family. In the central Russian provinces, you know, the commune developed in the first place because it's not the best place in the world to farm. It's very difficult soil. It's very bad weather. You have a growing season of about 6 weeks. It's a problem that, and it's been my thesis over the last, I don't know, decade or so, that one of the reasons that things developed the way they did, and the centralization of the czar and the bureaucracy, came into existence largely because of the difficulty of really developing good and positive and profitable harvests in that part of the world. Now, I think the condition of the land, remember, this really was a private sector movement. When I said before it was an allotment, what I really meant to say is that they had the legal right to this thing. It was done at the private sector. However, the state did guarantee any loans that were taken out at a minimal rate of interest. These were backed by the state. And I want to make something very clear, and I'm sure you've come across this at one time or another. Both the reforms of Peter Stolypin, as well as the railways that were being built at the same time by Sergei Vita. Now, these two reforms have to go together because you want to increase the yields from the yeoman farms, but that's not going to do you any good unless you have the railways laid down. To transfer them throughout the country and then outside of the country. So these two sets of reforms from two prime ministers at different times, two very talented men, both of whom, by the way, were of Western or of the Central European background, these reforms paralleled one another. But what I want to say, the point I want to make, is in both cases, it was the state that financed and backed these investments. The government in St. Petersburg did not want to go to the Sassoons in Paris, where they had gone in the past, and they were in debt to Paris, but not nearly as much as elsewhere in Europe. They wanted to finance all of this via the state, and that was, at least as far as international banking is concerned, that's when they painted the crosshairs on themselves.
So now, before the program ends, Matthew, I want to talk about a tendency from the Putin government to want to re-centralize again before the program ends, but I don't want to get to that yet. You mentioned the Sassoons. Are you talking about the Sassoon family formerly in Asia who were tied with the Rothschilds?
Absolutely. This is the same group. Their main headquarters was in Paris. They were big, as you mentioned, in Asia. They were underwriting the opium trade. Along with the Rothschilds in Great Britain, and using the British government and the Asia Company to promote this. So these aren't exactly, you know, this is your classic, typical banking cult, and it was French. Now, see, the thing is, St. Petersburg was cultivating ties with France because the British were extremely threatened at the rapid expansion of Russian industry, railways, and economic growth from the reign of Alexander II to the time of the Stolypin reforms starting in 1906, 1907. And so the Rothschilds and the Sassoons were now at odds because the Sassoons had no problem in floating loans to St. Petersburg, and yet the Rothschilds were saying, this is outrageous, we can't allow these people to grow any further because they're putting tremendous pressure on British holdings in the Middle East, in Central Asia, and in the Far East. The Rothschilds responded to this by floating a huge loan. And actually, this is a few years earlier, responded to this economic growth at the turn of the century by floating a huge loan with the Japanese government, building essentially what was a British-Japanese navy to be able to hem in the Russians in the East. And, of course, that exploded in 1905. And not only were these Japanese ships 100% British, they had British officers on them.
Is that right?
So this is the Rothschilds' response, and yet the French government loved the idea of helping to build Russia up so as to control British and to some extent German interests in Russia, both in the South and in the West. So when we talk about these reforms, we need to put it in the international context of the time.
Now I have never been aware that a tension grew between the Rothschilds and the Sassoons. Is the Sassoons family, the Sassoon family still, do they still exist as financiers? Who are their banks? I know I'm a bit off topic, but that's got me very interested.
Well, I'm not entirely sure what happened to the Sassoons once World War II came into existence. I think the Rothschilds right now are so overwhelmingly dominant, they may well have absorbed that particular family. Ultimately, their interests were parallel. But because the Sassoons were connected with the French government, the Rothschilds connected with the British government, that couldn't help but eventually... that was solved in World War I because they fought on the same side. But prior to that, the Rothschilds and St. Petersburg were bitter, bitter enemies. The worst rivalry in Europe, prior to 1912, where the German issue, exploded and made it impossible for England to fight Russia anymore. The greatest rivalry in Europe was St. Petersburg and the city of London. So, yeah.
Now we did a small segment on a program about the Council of Vienna, where the tension between the Rothschilds and the Russians really came to the surface. Perhaps as a foundation for this, maybe you could speak just to that for just a few moments.
Well, what we're dealing with is the question of the Balkans. We're dealing with the clash between, remember, who chaired this? It was Metternich who chaired this. Now we're talking about the Congress of Vienna in 1814?
Oh, I'm sorry, 1814. That's correct. Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. I just wanted to make sure we're on the same page here.
No, that's right. For some mysterious reason, I've got 1825 in my notes, but I know that's not correct. That's right.
Yeah. Well, think of it this way. It's immediately after Russian victory against Napoleon. So then Alexander the First is the absolute dominant figure in European life, and it's really from this moment on that the Russian monarchy becomes truly European, becomes truly dominant in Europe. And the fact is in the British mind, to a great extent, Alexander the First ends up taking the place of Napoleon. They're just as threatened by Alexander and his successors as they were with Napoleon. And this stress will blow up eventually under the reign of Nicholas the First in the war in the Crimea.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be noted that Alexander the First was there in person, and he was there to at least attempt to create a league dedicated entirely to peace, and the British were also threatened simply because Russia was able to keep Finland entirely, was given most of Poland, and so now you have a huge expansion in Russian power in Europe, and the Rothschilds in London were extremely upset by this. But their freedom of action, as far as Russia is concerned, again, was strained because Russia was simply too politically and militarily dominant at the time.
So now we have tension arise between Nathan Rothschild and Tsar Nicholas. A few years later, I'm giving just a very broad overview just to some of our listeners who might be scratching their heads a little bit, and this was well before the Stolypin reforms. So now we have a number of reforms in Russia. There's beautiful infrastructure being built, the rail, people are moving inland. The country looks pretty much indestructible. It has begun to decentralize. Of course, it's hard. It's a hard land, huge winters, but tremendous resources. Now we have the trouble that began as a result of a communist revolt around the turn of the last century. Can you give us some comments on that?
All right. I want to say, though, I mean, I think it's worthwhile that you bring up the Congress of Vienna. The Balkan issue develops a little bit later, but I think it's a result of the Congress of Vienna. You're right to make the connection that you make. The connection that you're making is that from this moment forward, Russia is now a major power to be reckoned with, if not the major power. Because remember, at the time of the Congress of Vienna, Germany had yet to unify, and they had yet to engage on this explosive growth in the very beginning of the 20th century, the end of the 19th century. Russia is growing, as you already said, at a tremendous rate. She is slowly beginning to industrialize. She is attracting a lot of foreign investment, and I want to say again, it's mostly French investment. A lot of the industry was of foreign backing, a lot of it backed by the Sassoons, the major French banking clan, French Jewish banking clan. This is a problem. And you couldn't help but have tension between the London Rothschilds and the Sassoons in Paris, when in fact the Sassoons, for their own profit, were following the desires of the French government in building up Russia as much as possible to control Germany. Now that's going to develop. The Congress of Vienna is a little early. That's going to develop, especially after the Crimean War, and at the same time, the French have an interest in controlling the growth of British imperialism in Central Asia and the Far East. But if you're looking at the map of Europe, say in the middle of the 19th century, you're absolutely correct. Russia seems invincible, and in 1861, the serfs are freed with land, and so they receive the communal land, which they can do with as they please within the communal structure, which is very natural to Russia. And you had extraordinary economic growth throughout the 19th century. And so to try to connect this with what we're talking about originally, the Stolypin reforms, that was really the last straw for a lot of the Western banking clans, because now the idea is if the Tsar is able to oversee a country of yeoman farmers backed by state credit, not foreign credit, state credit, we're never going to get rid of the Tsar. The Tsar is going to be permanent and genuine. I think the Tsar was fairly popular for the most part within Great Russia. But to have millions of small landowners, and don't forget something else, Tsar Nicholas was offering free passage, free tools, free seed money for any family that would move to Siberia and in the more pleasant, fertile parts of central and southern Siberia. So the world powers are saying you're going to have Russian landowners in southern and central Russia, and now they're going to go and colonize Siberia, and at the same time they are exploding in terms of population. Yeah, there's going to be a billion Russians in a few decades if we don't do something about this. A billion Russians with a rapidly growing economy under a popular czar. I'm telling you, if the revolution didn't happen between 1918 and 1921, Russia would be the world's leading dominant power by far, and I think Europe would be a backwater by comparison.
Yes. Now, look, I believe that. I've come to believe that in the last few years. Now, with the majority of these people that were later slaughtered as a result of the revolution, pretty much to a man were Christian. There were probably no Muslims. There might have been some were, I guess you'd call nominal, but would that be right, saying that they were almost certainly all Orthodox?
They were most certainly almost all Orthodox.
What about my quote of Heinrich Heine, that they went after the throne because the throne protected the altar? Am I correct to make an association with Tsar Nicholas and Russia, or am I drawing a long bow?
No. I think you are absolutely correct, both in terms of the French Revolution and the Bolshevik Revolution. Mm-hmm. And let me give you a little bit of proof here. Proof number one, there was no attack on synagogues. Synagogues were permitted to function, like nothing.
Yes.
There's no record of any synagogue being destroyed by the Bolsheviks as the churches were being pulled to the ground. Number two, The Old Believers, a group that I have a book out on, the Old Believers were extremely strict Russian Orthodox people that were separated from the Church of Moscow and St. Petersburg. They were pretty much anarchist in their political point of view, and they were persecuted at least for a while in the 19th century. They were no political threat whatsoever to the Bolsheviks. If anything, they would have been completely neutral, if not supportive, of the revolution that overthrew the Tsar. And yet the Old Believers were slaughtered and liquidated and sent to the camps as a group. So it proves that it's not for political reasons. It's not for political, because even the Orthodox groups like in Ukraine that were opposed to Tsarism were liquidated just as violently as the Orthodox groups in Russia that supported Tsarism. Mm-hmm. And that's always a proof that I bring out once in a while to show that it was religion, it was Christianity as such, not Christianity's connection to the Tsar.
Christianity. So the real target, as we're leaning towards here, or a real target, was Christianity. Now, how was the landowners, something that has escaped me, Matthew, and I apologize for my ignorance here, you said that the Tsar offered great assistance for people moving into Siberia on their own. Were these separate from the Stolypin reforms?
They were closely connected. This is something that was hatched from Tsar Nicholas's brain. But you understand the mentality is exactly the same. Because these the St. Petersburg government was to back financially this move of people to Siberia, where there's lots of land, including lots of fertile land. And they were given that free of charge. And they were given all the tools that they needed, all of this free of charge. They didn't have to do anything.
Yep.
And the idea was to relieve population pressure in the central provinces on the one hand, and on the other hand, to build up a yeoman farmer movement in Siberia. There were no communes in Siberia. It was individual farmsteads. It didn't exist in Siberia. It's like in northern Russia. There were no communes in northern Russia either. The commune is largely a central province phenomenon. It's a very ancient phenomenon, but it is limited geographically. And so, yes, it is connected to the Stolypin reforms, at least ideologically, and it was about building this yeoman class to destroy any of the criticisms of the revolutionaries.
Now, you said that the land was owned, we have this question in the West that, well, I own the land, but I pay taxes on the land, so I really don't own the land, therefore I guess I'm not really a landowner. What was the level of land ownership? Did they own it outright? You said they could do it as they pleased?
Well, I said that in relation to the commune. I don't believe that communal land holding was something that was completely the opposite of actual land holding. It was owned by the commune. People had a right to land within the commune, and it was redistributed sometimes every decade, sometimes more than that, depending on the family size, depending on need, and depending on other economic variables in the commune. Those fairly well-off peasants who left the commune and took advantage of Stolypin's reforms, yes, they could do whatever they pleased with that land, and although, of course, most of them had no interest in alienating it, they wanted to work it, and they wanted to profit from it. But this is why I had to mention the Vita railway building project, which occurred at the same time as the Stolypin reforms, because you needed to have the transportation there. So this was about building market-oriented farms within Russia.
Excellent. And, of course, this is exactly the opposite condition that's taking place in America and many of our Western countries today. The rail infrastructure has gone to pieces. There's heavy centralization. They're pretty much our laws coming now, S-510 food laws, where it's going to almost be illegal to grow if you're not supporting the quote-unquote system here. So the internationalist is getting what they want in the so-called free West, and they had to destroy what was happening in Russia just a little over 100 years ago. So what did the... Go ahead.
No, I couldn't possibly agree with you more. You know, it's taken me 10, 15 years to reach this conclusion, and here you have reached it already, and you're absolutely correct. The fact is, as you know, I got my PhD at the University of Nebraska, and I spent a lot of time traveling in the agrarian part of central and eastern Nebraska And if you want to see poverty and misery and death, small towns falling out of existence because ConAgra and Archer Daniels Midland, with the support of the Department of Agriculture, have absolutely destroyed the small and even the medium-sized farm. And nobody cares, of course. I mean, it's an absolute, it's practically genocide, where entire small towns go out of existence and no one cares, which means the following. And I wrote this in my first book, The Third Rome, and I said, look, there's no doubt then that the monarchy that existed in Russia was far more, was far better to its farmers, was far more moral in terms of ideas of land ownership and building that yeoman virtue, and yet the democratic and republican systems in the West have been, especially in the United States, have an open policy of destroying small towns, of destroying the family farmers, and giving this power over to the mega farmers at ConAgra and Archer Daniels Midland and a bunch of these other groups, all of whom, by the way, are big financial supporters of globalism and internationalism in academia and in politics and everything else. So the point is, what does it say about the two different forms of government? You have a monarchy here, you have a democracy here. Look at the results. Which system has proven itself better?
Yes.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Just for your information, Matthew, here in Australia, when you travel small towns, the same thing is happening here, where the intent is to centralize. The small towns here are pretty much all in unemployment, on welfare. Now, not everybody, but if you walk the streets and you say, okay, well, you know, how many of these people are actually producing anything? It's probably 0.1%. And the rest are simply on the consumerist bandwagon. They're just going round and round and round and round. We visited a town the other day, my wife and I, and just up the main street. This is a nice little place. Geographically, it's beautiful. It's like about 25,000 people. Just up the street, our friend who was with us counted, I think, 8 opportunity shops, you know, like Salvation Army outlets and, you know, right, food relief places. And you think, this town is dead. The majority of young women that we saw were overweight, truly the majority, many of them tattooed, bad teeth. You think, this town is dead. They're killing this town. And so it's not only America. I'm sure it's happening in the UK, but really this centralization is destroying Western civilization.
Absolutely. I know this from personal experience. I know this from all of my travels in the Midwest. I have seen everything that you say. The diet, these people are so poor. They've had everything taken from them. Any chance of building any kind of economic infrastructure has been destroyed by Walmart, who has moved in. It's odd how Walmart has moved into these tiny towns. You wouldn't think that they have a big market there, but they completely dominate the economic world of the county that they're located in. That's the only job available. Their diet is terrible. They're overweight and disgusting. And they're glued to the television. Their whole world it revolves around. It is an absolute total genocide of what once was a very proud Christian Midwestern a tradition of small town life, and I know it very well. I've lived in what's left of it, and it is open genocide, and of course no one cares.
Yep. Now, what we have in the West, is a kind of urbane genocide. It's kind of a velvet glove happening slowly. We're going to poison you with bad water, junk food. We'll give you a rotten, stupid culture that you think is important, and we'll gradually decay your mind so that the strong ones can still fight in our wars. But what happened in the East, what happened in Russia, what happened in the Ukraine was brutal. It was severe in the extreme. What we have in the West is communism by stealth, but in the West, in the East, it was communism by the gun. So right. Let's come back now and have a look at what happened to these peasant farmers when the revolution started to take place.
Oh my God! First of all,
I know it's a huge topic.
It's a huge topic, and it's depressing. And I sometimes wonder why I specialize in these things, because really, you can't have a happy life reading about this stuff all day. Because in academia, it's perfectly legitimate for a professor to go in front of a class and say, "I'm a communist, and I think Lenin was wonderful." These people are promoted and given six-figure salaries. I go up and I say something positive about the Third Reich, and they're going to shoot me. And it really just shows you how fraudulent it all is. But what I want to say is, you read the works of Bernstein or Leon Trotsky, and he really has a venomous hatred for the farmer and for the Russian peasant.
Yes.
He views the Russian peasant as raw material that needs to be processed. He calls it a protoplasm that needs to be processed into the new Soviet man, of course, completely controlled by the party.
Interrupt for 1 second. Our English listeners have a problem with the word peasant. If you could define peasant as not some poor, miserable, empty-pocketed slave for us, because we're going to use the word a lot in the next few minutes.
Oh, you're absolutely, that's a very good idea. Of course, when I refer to peasant, I am not referring to an economic category. I'm referring to a legal category.
Yes.
A peasant was a separate legal category that goes from very, very poor, landless workers, the so-called rural proletariat, all the way up to fairly well-off peasant landowners. There were plenty of peasants that were far wealthier than the nobility. The nobility in Russia at the turn of the century was in severe decline. And there were a lot of market-oriented farmers that were developing, and so the concept of a peasant is a legal category where they were, up until the Stolypin reforms, required to, if they were to stay in the countryside, required to be a part of the communal town structure. Stolypin reforms altered the definition of a peasant, meaning that he can now be a citizen landowner on his own, outside of the commune. But remember, I mean, that was very controversial. A whole lot of peasants loved the communal structure. It was secure. Mm-hmm. It was the extended family, in essence. So I don't want to say that this yeoman thing, this was the best thing in the world, because a lot of people really liked the other, the communal structure. It really depended on your attitude. It depended on how well you were doing. So when I refer to peasant, I'm talking about not an economic category, but a legal category.
Excellent. Okay, now back to our topic. You can read in Trotsky's writings and others a loathing, a disgust for these people. Why?
Absolutely. Well, number one, this was the Christian backbone of the country. These were some of the most pious people. I say one of the most pious people in the world. Whether they were poor or wealthy, the church life was constant. A Russian peasant was off from work a solid 100 days out of the year because of all of these holy days, all of these fasting seasons.
100 days of the year.
Absolutely. I mean, especially in the more fertile areas of Russia, peasants at the turn of the century, they didn't work nearly as much during Lent because they didn't eat very much. They had holy days throughout the year constantly. The summer, I think, was really the big, 12-hour days was in the summer. But the rest of the year, that's typical of agrarian life anyway. The rest of the year, I think they had a normal 8-10-hour day like most of us. They had a lot of days off, and I think capitalism really hated this. Capitalism comes into Russia from France, and they hated the concept that these Russian peasants wouldn't show up on St. George's Day, St. Michael's Day, the protection of the Mother of God, all of these different days. They wouldn't show up to work. This was the day we went to church, and of course the church service was 10 hours long back then. And on your feet. And because we had no pews, Orthodox churches don't have pews. Thank God for that. That you stand for everything. And this was the typical rhythm of peasant life. So that's the first reason. The second reason is the Soviet government, when they finally consolidated themselves by the mid-20s, the peasants were by far the most violently opposed to the Soviet takeover. They were the most violently opposed to what later develops, as we all know, with collectivization. And it was the collectivization drive that led to the open genocide, not just in Ukraine, although Ukraine got hit the hardest, but also in parts of Great Russia as well. So these were people that Trotsky was no moron. He was immoral, but he wasn't stupid. And he knew that there's going to be one class of people that hates us, and that's going to be the peasants. And therefore, that's the group that needs to be disciplined, so to speak. And he was very, very clear and open about this.
Now, when this began, and people were taken from the land, was the land then immediately taken back and turned into collective farms, or did it lie dead for a while? I guess it must have happened differently all over Russia.
Yeah, well, that's complicated because, of course, during the Civil War itself, there were a lot of areas of land that just weren't cultivated at all. Now, during the Civil War, both the Red and the White armies, and I've made it clear in my writings that the White Army was just as bad as the Red Army.
Oh, is that right?
Absolutely. First of all, these were not monarchists. These were the representatives of the provisional government of Kerensky, for the most part. So it was essentially the Kerensky government versus the Red Army. And that's what this, now you did have some, conservative Christians within the White Army. I'm not denying that. But, what both armies began to do in the countryside is called grain requisitioning. And that's a fancy word for saying that detachments of soldiers would go out into the fields, steal whatever they want, go into the barns and steal whatever they want. And if you said anything about it, you were shot. And that's how they fed the army. So by the time 1921 comes around and the Civil War is over, the Bolsheviks have taken over, farming had come to a standstill in Russia. So now you had famine conditions. Now you had Woodrow Wilson openly writing a blank check to the Soviet government, sending food aid to the Soviet government, and the support of this, and I have an article in a broadcast coming out on this very soon, because even the academic literature accepts this idea that the West supported the Soviet government, aided it in every way possible, and bailed it out again and again and again and again from 1925 to the Gorbachev era.
Yes.
So you had grain requisitioning, which eventually led to farmers who would rather shoot their cattle than have it be stolen by the Reds or the Whites.
Yep.
And so you had famine conditions by the early 1920s, and that's when Lenin engaged in his new economic project or new economic program, which permitted something along the lines of a Stolypin-style landowner that was capable of selling grain at market prices. This was Lenin's idea, and Lenin knew that he needed to let the market work in grain or else they would never get out of this famine, and so Russian agriculture began to develop. It was this class, the NEP farmers, that when Lenin died in the mid-20s, that Stalin desperately needed to destroy, because Lenin had inadvertently created a group of farmers very much like Stolypin had created.
Fairly.
So, now, I don't believe that there was an immediate connection between Stolypin and Lenin. The Bolsheviks loathed Stolypin.
Yes.
But it was simply a tactical move. Lenin had no other choice. I need to permit these people to own land for a while and to sell grain and meat and other things at market prices, or else we're never going to get out of this famine. Lenin died.
That extended into the Ukraine as well?
Oh, absolutely. This was nationwide. And Ukraine, this is a place that's a heck of a lot more fertile than Great Russia. Not to mention, it's far better positioned to trade with the rest of the world. It does border the Black Sea, after all.
Sure.
And, Ukraine, and it has a tradition, longer than Russia, a long tradition of independent yeoman of farming. So the Ukrainians developed into a fairly prosperous farming nation under Lenin. Then Lenin dies in 1925-26, and then Stalin has to put an end to this.
Right. Now, here's an area where I have, it's been a vacuum in my thinking, and you filled that out for me, Matthew, and that was, how was it that Lenin went after the peasants so much, and then Stalin again went after the peasants? Is it the same bunch, or was it a 30-year war against the peasants or whatever? But now I understand that actually Lenin reinvigorated that class, albeit you're saying out of desperation.
Right.
And then Stalin goes after them. Now, the term kulak, is did both Lenin and Stalin use the term kulak to refer to them?
Well, the word kulak means fist in Russian.
Oh, it does?
Yeah, well, it means fist in the sense that you could beat down your social inferiors. Also fist in the sense of being tight-fisted, like a moneylender.
Oh, yes.
The communes did, by the time the revolution was over, there were some communes that had developed wealthy peasants that did serve as money lenders, usually small item stuff. The new economic program had reinvigorated that class and had created a group of fairly well-off peasants that were engaged in money lending, and yet they were the most vigorous and successful of the farmers throughout the old, throughout the empire. So the kulak, at least initially, the word kulak was used, or kulaki in the plural, was used throughout Bolshevik writings. But it became kind of a slogan in the late 20s and early 30s, under Stalin. But the fact is, both in old issues of Pravda, as well as the documents at the time that have been translated in the academic journals, and I've gone through a lot of these, the word kulak does not have a stable definition. It never had a stable definition. The initial definition of kulak was somebody who can afford to hire a hired labor for like 6 months out of the year.
Okay. Sorry, I think I misdirected you a little bit, but it was I spent a bit of time. Now, I probably misused the term kulak, but I think that it was Stalin who spoke of destroying the kulaks to Churchill. Is that correct, or have I missed that? Or is that yet another misdirection from where you were going?
Oh, I don't know. I don't ever remember him talking about this to people like Churchill. I suppose he could have, because, you know, they certainly were good friends.
Yeah, if I can find the quote, I'll send it along to you after the fact. So, anyways, back to this. So we now have a situation where we're under Lenin now. We have this reinvigorated productive class, if you will, that's largely seems to be decentralized. And so now Stalin, and then so now Stalin goes to work on them.
Well, yeah. Lenin had inadvertently created a very strong, fairly well-off, and yet very anti-Soviet group of farmers.
Mm.
The farmers never reconciled, the peasantry, I should say, never reconciled itself to the Soviet government. This was something that's said by Trotsky and Lenin and Stalin. They all knew that their primary enemy was the peasantry.
Mm-hmm.
Stalin could not deal with the fact that you now have this fairly well-off strata that might be able to fight the Soviet government successfully. Remember, at this time, we're talking about the early 30s, there's nothing secure about the Soviet government at all.
Mm.
The church had gone officially into exile in Central Europe, and also in Nationalist China at the time as well, and they were convinced that their exile is going to be short-lived. The Soviet government's going to eventually fall, and we could go home. Stalin was insecure. The Soviet Union was insecure at the time. They were receiving aid from the United States, of course. They were receiving aid from the Red Cross and similar organizations. But the destruction of the kulaki were come from Stalin and his movement as a way to keep the peasants from being too uppity in their demands, to keep them from becoming a force against the Soviet government. And, of course, ultimately, even Lenin realized that the purpose would be eventually collectivization. So, I mean, this was just a temporary measure. So the point was that this was just a way to fatten up the peasant so that he could then be collectivized. And collectivization itself was just a way to create sort of an anti-commune that was directly under party control. And the so-called machine tractor station, which was a place where the government would have tractors and fuel and everything else, most of which came from the Ford Motor Company, that was, by the way, heavily invested in Ukraine at the time, and they would control all of the seed and equipment and everything else, and the peasants can use them as they saw fit. And so the Soviet government created the so-called Committee of Poor Peasants. The Committee of Poor Peasants really were is a party organization within the collective, and they were there to keep an ideological watch over anyone and everyone, and they were used as a hammer to send uppity peasants to the camps, if not kill them directly right there in the collective. So this was a party. This was a way of, number one, transferring the land to the party. It was a huge wealth transfer, and of tightly controlling agricultural production, and number three, controlling the peasants. Now, Stalin added an ethnic question in that he realized that Ukrainians were not interested in being part of the Soviet Union for the most part, especially in the West, and they wanted essentially to be an independent state, or at least be a part of a very loose, a loose Russian Empire, that they could be essentially autonomous. And so crushing Ukrainian resistance was something very, very important in Stalin's mind. Remember, Stalin's role in the Lenin's government was he was the minister for nationalities.
Yes. So I didn't know that. Okay.
That was his job in Lenin's government. So he was very much aware of the ethnic problems in the Tsarist Empire and in the Soviet Union, and he really had it out for the Ukrainian nationalist movement, which in the 1920s. Was tremendously well developed, including their own Orthodox Church and everything else, and so that needed to be nipped in the bud. So Stalin views collectivization as a way of killing a whole lot of birds with one stone.
Now, is Stalin being Georgian? Was there a tension between between Georgians and Ukrainians or not? Am I reading too much into that?
Oh, no. If anything, Georgians and Ukrainians were very much allies for a whole lot of reasons. Stalin, I believe, was ethnically Jewish. He was fluent in Yiddish, and he married only Jewish women, and his children only married Jews.
So
I do believe that he was Jewish ethnically.
I wondered that. I knew, of course, he'd married three Jewish women. I knew that, and we've talked about the fact that Kaganovich, his brother-in-law, was one of the greatest mass murderers of all time. As for Stalin himself, I did not know that he spoke Yiddish. That's very interesting.
Oh, no, I've heard that from numerous places, and I know that during the Cold War, Jews in America who were politically conservative really started this mythology that Stalin was anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic, and nothing could be further from the truth. He surrounded himself with Jewish party members, and he did oppose Jews and Gentiles who opposed him and destroyed them, but that certainly was nothing against Jews. I don't believe that Stalin was anti-Jewish in the slightest. But it made, for Jews in America and Western Europe, it made being anti-Soviet okay. Mm-hmm. If we could prove that Stalin was an anti-Semite. If Stalin was an anti-Semite, then we could be, anti-Soviet. Because for the most part, under Lenin, the Jews of Western Europe generally were pro-Soviet. And that was something that was simply a part of being Jewish. I know people like Murray Rothbard and other Jews in America, used to talk about this at some length. But once they started this mythology that Stalin didn't like Jews, then for Jews in America and elsewhere, it suddenly became fashionable to be anti-Soviet. So, but I think that's a lot of nonsense. Stalin was very, very philo-Semitic and surrounded himself with powerful Jewish politicians.
Yeah, it's hard to swallow that he wasn't, given the people that surrounded him, given his wives. I didn't know that his children all married into the Jewish community. So
yeah, exclusively.
Yes, that's very interesting. That would be the topic for another program. Matthew, tell us how people can get a hold of your material.
Well, I'm shutting down my actual website, and what I'm doing is I'm shifting everything over to the Voice of Reason Network. They've been very good to me. I fully support the mission of Voice of Reason, and you can simply Google Voice of Reason Network. ReasonRadioNetwork.com is the address, and we have a number of talk show hosts there on really every conceivable faction of the right wing, so to speak, that you could really think of. Every faction is represented there. My books are for sale there on Slavic topics, and I have a lot of articles that I give away for free there as well. And all of my radio broadcasts over the last 2 years are archived there, too. So I encourage you guys to continue to support AD70, of course, but also give us a look, too. I don't think you'll be sorry.
No, I've been a listener to Tom Sunek and to yourself, Carolyn Yeager and others for a while now, and I kind of like the format and the layout. It's in many respects similar to what we've done here. It's not in your face. It's good. Now, are you closing down Rus Journal then?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's old. I'm tired of it. The hits that they're getting now on Voice of Reason are tremendous. It's really growing, and it's growing quickly. And I think the format of the audio and radio, I think, is far more accessible than these long written pieces that I have online. No one's really reading that kind of thing anymore online.
People don't. We dumbed them down. They don't read anymore, Matthew. So, if anybody wanted to come to your church, where is that? If they wanted to sit under your ministry.
Well, I live kind of as a hermit now, for the most part. I have a small chapel in Franklin County, Pennsylvania. You could look that up as well. And my email is on the Voice of Reason site. And so I'm certainly willing to correspond with anyone and everyone about Orthodoxy and the Church and the ancient Church Fathers and everything else. And if you want to come see me, you email me, and we can make arrangements for that. But I encourage and I answer all emails, and I do it very quickly. And I encourage as much dialogue, respectful dialogue, as possible. So I encourage all of the listeners here to go to Voice of Reason, get my email, and I'd be happy to talk with you.
Excellent. If you ever come to Sydney, you've got a Sunday morning slot in our congregation.
So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Mike, God bless you. Matthew, God bless you. Mike, I'm going to hand it back to yourself this morning.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
You're tuned in to Radio Ariad.